Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This weekend in Retronauts, it's time to talk about The Wizard. Super Famicom this weekend to see this panel. I'm Jeremy Parrish, co-host of Retronauts. With me also is
Chris Sims, occasional guest on Retronauts, right here in Greensboro, North Carolina.
And we're here with a special guest this weekend, none other than Luke Edwards, one of the stars of the movie The Wizard.
Hey guys.
Yay!
So, Luke, thanks for coming. You were telling Chris that you don't come to a lot of gaming conventions, is that right?
I don't. This might be my second.
Oh, really? Yeah. So, you know, when you were recording, you know, filming the movie 28, 29 years ago, did you stop at any point and think, you know, I'm going to be sitting in a hall full of people talking about this movie 30 years from now?
That thought didn't occur to me. The possibility is out there, I suppose, but I never thought it would be.
Well, just to add a little context here before we get started, I'm sure everyone here in the room knows what The Wizard is, but of course it was a film produced back in the late 80s. Was it like bankrolled by Nintendo or something? There's a very strong presence of Nintendo, specifically Nintendo, not just video games, in that movie.
They didn't bankroll it. They were involved at that time. You know, product involvement with film was way, way different. So they they were involved, but they weren't involved to the degree that companies are now.
Right.
So they, you know, in a lot of instances, they just handed off products and said,
so, like, find a way to get this into the movie.
Include this, okay, and we'll be happy.
Which is how you end up with kind of weird things like Nintendo games and arcades. I mean, right. Some of that existed to a certain degree, but not quite to the degree that you see in this movie.
Right, right. Yeah, when we watched it last night, I remembered that, you know, all of the cabinet games that those games didn't exist.
Right.
So I guess some did. I mean, maybe you could find contraband.
Yeah, there was something called the Play Choice 10 where they would take, right, you know, the NES games and they would put them into like a pay for time system where you could try them out. It was basically like before video rentals existed.
Right.
Like video game rentals.
Right.
That was how you went and tested, do I want to play the new Mario game?
Right.
But
right,
not all of those games necessarily showed up in the Play Choice 10 system. So, you know, if you're someone who's cataloged this kind of thing, chronicled it, you notice some little things like, oh, they took some liberties there. But that's okay, you know. Back to the Future 2 had Wild Gunmen, and that's not the real Wild Gunmen in that movie. So I think a certain level of Hollywood fakery is expected with this sort of thing.
Definitely. I mean, you know, video games at that time were still, you know, pretty marginal. I mean, it was getting big, but it was, you know, still pretty marginal.
Yeah, they were kind of clawing their way back from the edge of defeat.
Right.
So it was, this was kind of a big moment for video games in a way. It was a major Hollywood production focused around video games, and not in the sense of Tron, where it was all sort of fanciful, like the idea of video games, but actual video games, actual companies, and, you know, not only that, but sort of their role that they had in kids' lives at that point.
Yeah. Like,
there is an element of, you know, very genuine passion with the kids you see in the movie. I think that everyone out there who's watching the movie in 1989 could be like, I get that. I relate to that.
I know that game.
Exactly.
I love that game.
We were on the way over here this morning, and Jeremy and I were talking, and I told him that watching it again a couple days ago, it actually makes the movie feel less commercial because it's not just one company's games. It's not just like people only talk about Nintendo. You know, you've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in there, you've got Double Dragon in there. Obviously, Super Mario Bros. 3 is the big centerpiece, but it does. It weirdly feels very realistic to being a kid and you don't know about corporate divisions, you just know about video games. Right. And I thought that was actually really cool in retrospect. Because you would never see that today.
Right, that's the, you know, the difference between then and now is it would be strictly Nintendo products, right, if they were involved.
Yeah, we were talking about Wreck-It Ralph and how that's the closest you can come. But even in that movie, like the major games that you see are all like made up. They're all fake games made up by Disney. So it's not like you're like, oh yeah, Wreck-It Ralph. I'm familiar with that character and like him. It's like this is the first time you're encountering him.
So Luke, do you want to talk a little bit about sort of the role that you played in the movie and just kind of, I guess, the experience of playing Jimmy in The Wizard? Because you're kind of the main character in a sense, but not, you don't have, well, obviously, like, the biggest speaking role or anything, but you're always, like, the movie starts with you, and it's about your journey to Hollywood, kind of, I guess, seen through the eyes of Fred Savage's character.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of, you know, it's kind of strange, it's the titular character, but then I say, you know, maybe 10 things in the whole movie, and, you know, it is mostly about the world around him as he's, you know, not, you know, he's kind of passive. It was my first, you know, feature role, first studio film. You know, I was 8 years old. I had been acting for very long, maybe a year. And so it was a big job. Of course, also for me at the time, I was really oblivious to pretty much everything and anything that didn't involve G.I. Joes or, you know, Transformers or whatever. So I didn't really know what was going on. It didn't really mean that much to me, you know, at the time. It wasn't until kind of later that, you know, the perspective of who these people are and, you know, the scale of everything. But for me, you know, as a kid, as an 8-year-old, it was fun. We tripped around, you know. We went around to all around Nevada and, you know, Northern California and, of course, L.A. and stuff. And we got to do fun stuff pretty much every day. You know, I mean, making movies is often really tedious. There's a lot of downtime. But when we got to do stuff, it was fun stuff. So, you know.
So you say there was a lot of downtime. Did you fill that downtime playing video games? I mean, since the movie is about video games, I'm wondering, like, did Nintendo supply, you know, the craft trucks and everything with, like, video games you could go play while you're waiting for your food?
I only wish. the cruel thing about being a kid actor is when you have downtime, you have to go to school.
Yeah.
Right. You're only required to do 3 hours of school every day, which is like a lot less school. But when you're working it into a, you know, 9.5-10 hour workday, most of the free time you get, you're in the schoolroom with the set tutor.
So when you think back on production of The Wizard, you mostly think about homework.
There's a lot of that. There were, you know. All the instances in the film where my character is playing a video game, it was all a tape. Mm-hmm. And it was all a TV and a VCR and a tape of someone else playing, which is, you know, kind of cruel for an 8-year-old, experience for an 8-year-old. But there were times where we were shooting in arcades. And so the downtime when we were in arcades was great because then I could play games, and they would open up the front of the game, so I could just, you know,
hit the dip switcher.
Yeah, free play basically.
So when you were playing arcade games on film, was that actually you playing? You know, because I know one of the famous anecdotes for the movie War Games is that Matthew Broderick was very, very method actor and really went out and learned how to play Galio so he could be an expert. I'm sure that was like really hard work for him, you know, getting good at Galio.
It's research.
But, you know, so then he's actually playing. He was like, I want to be convincing. I want to play well. Did you have that opportunity, or was that all still taped?
Not at all. I would have loved to get really good at lots of games, but, I think that they're... You know, I think their thinking about it was that we don't want him to, like, space out, you know, on gaming and instead be focusing on what we're here to do,
make
a movie.
Yeah.
It was in almost every instance, you know, where it's on screen, it was a take.
I understand why they would do that, because you don't want to get actors distracted by playing a video game. You don't want to get them absorbed.
Right.
But I feel like for the character of Jimmy, like, Jimmy is absorbed by the video games. Is it more difficult to pretend to be playing in that context?
That was the challenge. Well, you know, not only that, but whoever they had taped playing the game, in my opinion, was not very good. And I'm just sort of a captive audience. I have to watch this person, in my mind, make mistakes, you know, and like screw it up. And you know, I'm going like, I could do this better. But of course, that's nobody's actually focusing on what the character is doing in the game. So it was a challenge. It was a challenge. It was hard. It was frustrating.
I'm actually really curious as to what the audition process was like. Because like you said, you know, maybe 10 lines in the movie.
Yeah.
The word California is said quite a bit. When you went in and read for the part, like, what did you read?
That's, you know, I actually don't have a lot of memory of that process. I know that it was... I'm friends with the director, Todd, and we see each other on a kind of, semi-regular basis. He's talked a lot about it, and what he has to say is really interesting, because he has memory of it. My memory of it is so kind of spotty, 8 years old. I do remember that it was a difficult process for them, and I remember that he said that when I came in to read, that I was kind of different from all the other kids in that I was able to be really focused, where like a lot of, at 8 years old, often hyperactive or, the thing that I came in and did was just, laser focus on, whatever they were trying to, whatever the material was, which I don't think we used material from the film because there's nothing that, and that's a really common practice, is, taking material from other stuff or, maybe even writing stuff specifically for the audition. That happens a lot. When I did True Detective a couple years back, and they actually had me read Colin Farrell's scene for the audition. A really, really intense, emotional scene. Where he's like talking with his ex-wife about his son. It's really heavy and intense, and so that's what they had me read, and it had nothing to do with the character I ended up playing. It's a common practice. They do that, especially with shows like that, because they're not, they don't want to release any vital information about the show.
Right.
Yeah. So.
What specifically brought you to this movie?
So I started. I ended up going to a school, in the San Fernando Valley. I went because basically the classes were free. My My mom had traded one of the owners of the school a massage for, a class. And they kind of said to me, hey, you want to go to acting school? And, 7 years old, I was like, I don't know, sure. I went and had a great time. It was really fun. As a kid, acting kind of can come naturally because it's just playing make-believe, right? I mean, who as a kid doesn't enjoy that or just do that, naturally? So I went and I had a great time. And since I've learned that this school is actually quite accomplished. Like, everybody as a young actor went through this school, Leonardo DiCaprio and River Phoenix and on and on, just, basically everybody, including, to this day, a lot of our current movie stars are as kids, went through this school. So, and the people who own the school, the teachers and the owners, also managed kids. So if they, if they saw somebody who they felt had, something, they would set them up with an agent and go to the actual auditions and coach us for the auditions, which is very, very rare. So I did. I honestly just kind of fell into it. I never had any intention or, thought of being an actor. Mm. Yeah.
And so this movie specifically, did someone come to you and say, we think we have a role that's perfect for you, or did your agent come to you and say, hey, we heard about this movie, we want to try out for it?
The kind of standard, Hollywood audition process. It's a fairly big film, a big feature role. There's not all that many for kids, so it was, it was a call that every kid of that age is gonna go on, and of course it's a video game movie. Everybody's right.
Did you know going into it that it was going to be, so focused around video games that it was going to be the debut of Super Mario Bros. 3, the biggest game of the year?
Not at all. I mean, really nothing about it. I mean, they don't tell you much. They give you some material.
I feel like the age of 7 or 8 years old is when you're just starting to figure out that actors exist. So, the people you see on TV aren't real.
Right.
So you're at that age, and then all of a sudden you're on a set with a director and the cameraman doing multiple takes. Obviously you've stuck with acting, but did that kind of... Is it possible for an 8-year-old to be suddenly disillusioned? Did that happen at all?
Like I said, I was kind of an oblivious kid. I really lived in my own world, and so I didn't really know. I didn't watch The Wonder Years. I didn't really know who Fred was. I kind of knew of his, celebrity, but I just didn't really have any connection to him. I definitely didn't know who Bo was. The only guy that I really knew was Christian. I'm not sure, but I think it was because of Heathers, the movie Heathers, which I don't know why. If I was watching that when I was 7, I don't know why I was watching it.
That is a little wild doing when I was 7 years
old. I don't know, I may be wrong about this, but I remember specifically that I knew Christian, I knew who he was, and I remember interacting with him, and he was super, super nice to me, and I remember being very oh, that's, oh, cool, he's a nice guy. He doesn't always seem like a nice guy in his characters. He's a really nice guy. Ah, cool.
Oh, yeah, you kind of touched on the fact that you had a very small speaking role in the movie, despite, the fact that you have so much screen time. Was that, something you had trouble dealing with? Was it frustrating? Did you want to speak more, or were you just kind of happy to go along with, the assignment they gave you?
That's a funny question. I don't know if I can... I was pretty happy doing my own thing. I was definitely aware that the other performers were doing a lot and mostly I was just kind of standing there. But I think that I was really you know, like I said, I love to be in my own world, so I was really good at just kind of entertaining myself. There is so much downtime on sets. There's so much time where you kind of have to just, you know, do your own thing. And I was always really good at that. I was always like, that's fine, leave me alone. I'm going to write stories in my head about, you know, dragons and stuff. I'm cool. It's really funny. We were watching the movie last night, and there's a part where we're in the casino and gambling and stuff, and I'm watching and I'm remembering that, you know, I'm kind of standing there, and I'm sure my direction was to walk off with everybody, and I didn't, and I'm sure I was just spacing out, and you know, Fred kind of pushes me, you know, he was kind of like, it's our cue, like, let's go, and, you know, I was totally in my own world, which, you know, it fit.
That's perfect for that movie.
It kind of just worked, I didn't have to do a lot, you know, outside of my, you know, my kind of natural thing.
So what was it like when the movie came out? Like, did you go back to like school and kids were like, hey, you're in Super Mario Bros. 3 movie?
Yeah, there was a lot of interaction with kids. They, you know, they all wanted the secrets and the, you know, I was promised a copy of Super Mario 3 by the producers. They never gave me one.
Oh.
They never.
All was built on lies.
Oh, man. Tell me about it. So I never had to play the game. So when I did go back to school and kids were like asking me about the game, you know, it was that's hard. It was like, well, I haven't actually played it, so I can't tell you. It was really funny. My neighbors at the time got the game, were playing it, and got all the way to the last stage world, couldn't beat it, and so they called me over. They were like, can Luke come over and help, you know, help us, basically. And I still had never played the game.
They read your press.
And I did. So the first time I ever played the game was playing the last level, just really hard.
Yes.
And I just died immediately, and they were so disappointed.
Oh.
And, you know, I was kind of like, well, what do you want?
You know, it's a movie, right?
Man, you know, this is the. It was a much more innocent time, the early 90s.
There's a lot about that movie that, you know, watching it yesterday, I was like, this would not fly in a movie right now. But even the Super Mario Brothers 3 thing, you know, when the movie was produced, that game was already out in Japan. It took like a year and a half to come over here. So anyone who knew that could have imported a copy and been able to play it, but no one knew that back then because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have this easy communication.
Right.
So, yeah, seeing Super Mario Bros. 3 for the first time in The Wizard was kind of, like, for all the Mario fans and Nintendo fans, it was kind of religious. They were like, wow, finally a sneak peek of this game that's coming out in a few months. But, you know, in Japan, they've been playing it for a year already.
Wow, that is so funny. I never knew that. I had a couple really close friends in grade school who were Japanese, and they had... or, you know, Japanese-American, they would have the games ahead of time. But it was all, you know, obviously all in, you know, Japanese. So through them, I actually got to play cool games. Not necessarily through doing this movie. Strange.
Yeah, you mentioned the casino scene, too. Like, there's a bunch of stuff in this movie that I look at it, and I'm like, they wouldn't be able to do this in a movie today. You know, like the private eye who's constantly after Jimmy and trying to take him back. Like, that just doesn't play well now.
Oh,
it's,
man.
It's hard to imagine.
He is so creepy. And it's really, like, it's so, so inappropriate. You know, at so many instances, on so many levels. But, you know, it really was a much more innocent time, you know, where that kind of stuff flew.
I had forgotten that there is a scene in that movie where you think a man is going to get beaten to death by four truckers. And then he just shows up in the next scene with a black eye.
Right. Oh, yeah, right. The most, like, you know.
Yeah.
They punched him once in the eye, and that was it.
We're done here. That's the code of the trucker. I remember seeing that movie, and I remember seeing the previews for it, and I remember seeing it when I was a kid, and it made such an impression. I don't know if I've watched that movie until a couple days ago, and you said you watched it last night, but things about that movie stuck with me, like the line, "He's got all 96. I was like, I wish I could own 96 video games. Only a wizard could give me that kind of magic power. As you moved away from it, and as time went on, and it kind of became this thing that kids who were growing up remembered so vividly, like, did you go back and revisit it ever?
I did. I have a strange relationship with every movie I've ever done. I don't particularly enjoy watching my own work. Todd, the director, actually forbade me from watching dailies, you know, which is kind of sometimes a common practice. Some guys don't do it at all. He kind of, as I said, forbade me from doing that. And that practice kind of stuck with me, and so I don't know, it's kind of a strange, there are a lot of actors who are this way, they're, you know, actors who have never seen the films that they've done, so I have, it's not that extreme for me, but I kind of have a similar relationship where I don't really enjoy watching my own work. I enjoy the films, I enjoy other people's work in the films, but I don't enjoy watching my work. So, you know, in a recreational way, I don't think I would ever revisit any of my films or, you know, projects, anything. The times where I do watch it is, you know, at events. And almost every time there is one, I say, I've seen this movie a lot, and I might duck out. And then I sit, and I watch the beginning of the movie, and I get sucked in. And I, you know, the truth is, I actually really like this movie. It's not the greatest, you know, piece of drama ever made, but it's fun. And there's so much cool, you know, for me, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, there's all this nostalgia, you know, that I get sucked into. And so anyway, I end up watching the movie every single time, and I have a great time, and I laugh, you know.
It's a fun movie.
It's fun.
And it's very memorable. And a thing that I really appreciate about it is it's kind of in that weird overlap period between, like, movies that are obsessed with technology and video games and hopping on trends and getting into the new thing, and then this weird, like, 70s aesthetic where there's truckers and there's, like, kids going on an adventure and, like, evil adults chasing them down. It's a really interestingly made and plotted movie, I think.
It really is. I love kid adventure movies. That's probably my favorite, you know, subgenre of films. You know, like, for me, watching Stranger Things has been super fun because it's like, you know, tapping into that thing, which, you know, there's not all that much of it. So yeah, that, you know, that dynamic of, like, kids going off in the world and, you know, scary world and having adventures. I love that. You know, I don't know. For me, it works.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of the wizard in Stranger Things season 2. I think you can see it.
They've never made a direct reference. A lot of shows have. I don't know if you know that show Goldbergs. Yeah, they've made a couple direct wizard references. Anyway, Stranger Things never has, but I keep watching for it.
Well, you know, it's a little early for it. I think that Stranger Things is set in 1984, so it predates the movie a bit.
That's right.
There's a lot of hanging out with arcades in that movie.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
I mean, yeah, sure. It definitely has that sort of same 80s vibe that you get because arcades were a thing back then. It was a place where people went to hang out and
you know, compete against each other and play around and, you know, just waste time. Like, those don't really exist anymore. It's certainly not in the same form that they used to.
Totally.
So, yeah, you get that, like, that slice of light. It's also, you know, a time before Amber Alerts,
right,
before cell phones, before, you know, a point where it would have been actually probably pretty easy for Jimmy's parents to track him down and, you know, for his face to show up all over the news and on people's phones and so forth.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very much, like, not even just with the video games, but it really... It's in a certain time, and I think it's a great sort of you know, like a timepiece that way. I think what do you call it? Like a time capsule. Yeah.
So yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very specific, you know, little piece of time. Yeah, I love, you know, the in Stranger Things the high score thing. You know, that, like, that at a time that was really an important thing. You know, I guess it's sort of been replaced now with, you know, competitive or professional, you know, kind of gaming, but, you know, there was a time where it was like, yeah, I got the highest score, I'm the coolest kid.
Yeah, absolutely. The last job I had, my boss was someone who got into the games industry and the games press because he was a high score champion on, like, Defender and stuff in the early 80s.
No way.
So, yeah, like, that was a career move. It was something you could build a life on.
Right.
Once upon a time.
You know, fame.
Exactly.
Or if you had the same three initials as someone who had done all the work, you could probably sneak in there. There's no way to verify it.
Yes, yes.
But you could just go around all the games and find the, you know, and, like, oh, that's me.
Yeah. That's me. I go by a different name. It's a very elementary school thing to tell people, I think. Or maybe that's just me. Maybe I just revealed that I was a liar as a child.
Domino's week-long carry-out deal, you can carry out large three-topping pizzas and now medium three-topping handmade pan pizzas for $7.99 each. It's pantastic news.
Cut. Puns?
You mean pans? Calling all pan addicts for two layers of cheese on crispy golden crust. So grab your panty packs, because Domino's large three-topping pizzas and medium three-topping handmade pan pizzas are $7.99 each. It's pandemonium. Pan-tastico. Carry-out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Just because you're listening to a video games podcast doesn't mean you have to eat like video gamer stereotypes. There are many more and many healthier meal options out there than hyper-caffeinated soda and junk food. Consider supplementing that all-pizza diet with a subscription to HelloFresh, a meal delivery kit service that brings you fresh food prep kits to your door. HelloFresh offers great convenience. They deliver food directly to your door in compact, insulated boxes. You can choose your delivery day in order to best fit your schedule, pause your account when you won't be around. All the ingredients come pre-measured in clearly labeled meal kits with simple instructions, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. Every week, HelloFresh offers a new selection of chef-curated recipes from one of three plans to choose from. There's Classic, which includes a variety of meat, fish, and seasonal produce. Veggie, packed with plant-based proteins, grains, and seasonal produce for those who prefer a vegetarian diet. And Family, quick and easy meals crafted to please and feed an entire family. Most recipes I've tried from HelloFresh don't take much more than 30 minutes to prep and cook. There's also a 20-minute meal on the Classic menu each week for when you really don't have much time. Plus, many recipes can be made in one pot, which means you won't have to worry about endless cleanup. And if you prefer your food portable for your gaming lifestyle, the good news is that not everything from HelloFresh involves juggling lots of plates. I'm a fan of their classic Poblano beef chili, which is delicious, healthy, and fits neatly into a single bowl for convenience. Right now, HelloFresh is offering a special trial deal for Retronauts listeners so you can experience their quality for yourself. Get $30 off your first week of HelloFresh by visiting HelloFresh.com and entering the code Retronauts30. That's Retronauts 30.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Hey humans, David Smalley here from the Dogma Debate Podcast, right here on Podcast One, where we talk about all the things you're not supposed to discuss at work: religion, politics, abortion, racism, slavery, and that's only when we open the Bible. We discuss Islam, Islamophobia. What does that even mean? We chat with vegans, animal rights activists, and even visit factory farms to see it for ourselves. I invite people from multiple backgrounds to convert me into their worldview. But as long as they're okay with being respectfully challenged, you better bring your evidence. And I never lose sight of how both the left and the right are seeming to lose their minds. So basically, we're solving all the world's problems right here on Dogma Debate.
And you've been missing it.
Watch our 360 virtual reality videos on the Podcast One app and download Dogma Debate on iTunes, Stitcher, or PodcastOne.com.
Stay in touch with any of the other cast members? Have you collaborated with them on anything in the years since?
I haven't. I see Fred, around town on a, I don't know, semi-regular basis, just in the sense that we run into each other. Fred's a real successful comedy director these days.
Okay.
Yeah. He's done, and it's very cool. He's done a lot of great shows, Always Sunny and stuff like that. So I look forward to the time when I can, work with him again and collaborate on something. I talk with Todd because he's, we go to events sometimes together, and he is such a super, super nice guy, and, has always been really complimentary. Other than that, I don't really see anybody. I have kind of a weird story about Jenny. I haven't seen her in probably 20 years. It had been a long time since I had seen her since we did the film together. Just to go a little deeper, Fred at the time was a huge star. Probably the height of his fame, and he knew it, and he was a kid star. He was the biggest kid star in the world, and he behaved as you might. Jenny and I got on really well, and we kind of like teamed up. I felt like I had a bond with her. And I didn't get to see her after, and it was a long, long, long time. Anyway, I was at a party in L.A., in Los Feliz, when I was like 19. And I was really drunk. And it ended up being her house. So I saw her, and we had a moment of like, oh my god, it's so good to see you, and however, I was drunk, and so it wasn't quite the reunion that I was hoping for, or that I have been hoping for since our filming. She's a big kind of rock star these days. She's maybe a little hard to get to. I don't know. Anyway, I hope to one day run into her again and have the, you know, the real reunion. And, but it hasn't happened yet. All these years later.
It's probably been interesting for you, kind of, you know, just as an observer, to watch some of your co-stars, like their celebrity grow, like with Jenny, and for others to kind of subside and kind of, you know, vanish from the limelight. I don't know, like, what has that experience been like for you, to just kind of watch, you know, to chart the careers of all these people you've worked with, not just in The Wizard, but, you know, in other films, like, you know, and just see how celebrity is kind to some people and not so kind to others.
It's bizarre. It's bizarre as doesn't even capture it. It's so strange. Fred's brother Ben was around the set. He was on, you know, he was around for, as my memory, basically the whole shoot. Ben was closer to my age, and so Ben and I got along really well. We played together a lot on set. Of course, after Ben, you know, did Boy Meets World, and so, you know, he has his whole career. You know, it's great to watch, and it's also very, very strange. You know, God, Christian Slater is, you know, he was a huge movie star at the time, and has kind of then had a lull in his, you know, work, and then shows up on Mr. Robot, and it's such a good show. I have two friends who are former acting students who are on the show.
Oh yeah.
No, I love the show, and they get to kind of see all my friends work again. It's like, oh man, that is so much fun. But it's really strange. I have a former student on Stranger Things. I get to see her in the, you know, in this second season. Oh my God, it's amazing to see, you know, people who have been trying to do it, you know, break through and get a, you know, get a job where it's, you know, very visible. But yeah, it's bizarre. You know, I worked with Christian Bale, you know, before he was Batman. Basically, he was still a, you know, a star at the time. I mean, his first job was a huge job, so he's like a known guy. But obviously, when you become Batman, everything changes.
You're Batman forever.
For better or worse. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, so many people over the years that I've been lucky enough to work with. And yeah, to watch their, it's a roller coaster, you know, this work in this industry for everybody. It's just a super roller coaster, you know, people who manage to continue to work, they beat the odds. It's insane. It's, you know.
Well, you continue to work. You've been in stuff like True Detective. Do you look back at your career and have any particular favorite standout role? Have you done anything that you really feel like, yeah, this is what I was really aiming for?
I feel like I'm still working towards that. Yeah, I mean, there's stuff that I enjoy more than others. For me, the first season of True Detective was one of the best shows I had ever seen, maybe the best. So for me to get to do that show was, you know, unbelievable, and to be the killer, you know, it was unbelievable job. The you know, this second season wasn't all that well received. The role that I actually played was, I mean, we shot this whole sequence, all this stuff. Oh my God, they had me stab a watermelon. All this stuff that we did and shot, none of it ends up in the show. So it was like, you know, it was a great job, amazing, and also super disappointing, you know, ultimately. So I don't know. I mean, there's stuff that I'm proud of. There's stuff that, you know, I've been really lucky to be a part of. And I am still working towards, you know, that thing, the career defining thing, if you want to call it that.
Well, it's good not to peak too early.
Yeah, right. yeah, a lot of my work recently has been also stuff behind the scenes producing, and writing and stuff like that. So I feel like I'm also still working towards, you know, creating something,
right?
You know.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, when you were on the site, you'd be like constructing these stories about dragons and stuff. Is that you're finally finding an outlet for those ideas?
That precisely, yeah. The you know, creating of stories has always been going on, and, you know, more recently learning to put it down on paper and put it out in the world.
If you have over the times you've watched The Wizard, and obviously seeing it with a bunch of people who are here to see watch this movie. I was about to say here to see The Wizard. That sounds very Wizard Oz. Like, I'm sure that's a really cool experience. But is there a moment? Do you have like a favorite part of the movie from seeing it now as an adult?
All my favorite parts of the movie are the most ridiculous parts of the movie, which.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's a lot of them.
I get such a kick out of the businessmen who that's like the first hustle. Mm-hmm. Those guys are ridiculous. Those characters are, it's insane. Two like guys in suits who are playing a cabinet game and like very serious about it. You know, and then Fred comes up and like, yeah, you guys are okay. And the guy's like, okay, I'm like a pro. Like, who, what? That never existed.
You say that. But my dad, when I was a kid, I took my dad lived in Ohio, I lived in South Carolina. I took my Nintendo up one summer. When I left, he bought a Nintendo and only bought one game, and it was Dr. Mario, and he would play it every day.
Oh my God.
He loved Dr. Mario and was very intense about it. He did not look joyful playing it. He was very intense.
It was work for him.
Yeah, I have in my notes that I was taking while I was prepping for this and watching the movie. What kind of world is this where businessmen wager on video games at a truck stop? It's crazy.
It's insane.
But you know, like, you have all these sort of plot contrivances that you sort of need to propel the story forward.
Right.
You're sort of, you know, kind of fudge reality a little bit to get the story to where it needs to be.
Right. It has to be some characters that have some money. Right? It can't just be kids who have some, you know, like, I'll bet you some quarters, that's not going to work. It's got to be like, or we can really take them for some. I just, you know, it's maybe not even so much the creation of that character, but the way that those guys played the character. it's just absurd, and I love it.
I think the thing that I really appreciate about that movie, and the thing that makes it feel less like a big advertisement for Nintendo, because I mean, obviously, there's the Power Glove scene, there's the Mario 3 scene, there's Bo Bridges getting obsessed with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game. But, like, a thing I genuinely appreciate about the storytelling in that movie, video games aren't the solution to the problem at all. Like, it's not what Jimmy wants. It doesn't fix anything at the end. And I kind of love that, because, again, I don't think that would ever happen today. Like, somebody from Nintendo would be like, so, Mario's gonna heal this child, right? And that doesn't happen. He wants something completely different.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that last night, that, you know, is, like, what kind of person is Jimmy? You know, we talked a little bit about autism, and, you know, that Jimmy, you know, is he autistic a little bit or a lot, or is he just, you know, kind of PTSD? Does he just kind of have, you know, and you know, Joe kind of said it's probably a little bit of both. I think that's really right on, that it's probably a little bit of both. So it's really interesting that, you know, they go on this wild adventure and he wins this thing, and ultimately Jimmy's probably mostly the same. You know, he's kind of, you know, there's some cathartic act where he's able to kind of like let go, you know, of this thing that, you know, is kind of haunting him. But also, he's still in his world, you know, he's still, you know, that. So, I don't know, a lot of people have asked me, like, what's the, you know, what happens after? What's the sequel? What, you know, what happens to all these people? And, you know, the reality is that Jimmy is probably, you know, he probably continues to live a pretty similar, you know, experience, which is kind of, you know, it's, I don't know, it's not exactly a happy ending, you know? It's a little dark.
It is, but it's, I feel like, you know, if Jimmy is, you know, on the autistic spectrum, mm-hmm. like, the way this movie handles it is so much better than you usually see now in Hollywood, where autism becomes a superpower, and you have, like,
right.
Sherlock or The Good Doctor or something, where, like, someone has superpowers because they're on the spectrum, and that's not how it works. Like, it, you know, that sort of thing is much more like what Jimmy experiences, where... You know, it just kind of disconnects him from the rest of the world.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, like, that was something that really kind of caught my attention as I was rewatching it. Like, you know, with more of an awareness of things like that, you know, issues like that. Like, I'm kind of surprised that a movie of this vintage handled it the way it did. It doesn't really make light of it. Like, people are mean to Jimmy. Like,
right.
You see that in real life. Like, that's how people act. You know,
yeah.
So with autism.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cruel sometimes, but like it doesn't feel like the movie itself is picking on Jimmy. It's the people within the movie, like the people around him who make his life hard.
Right. Yeah. Well, the awareness of that has changed so much. You know, we didn't in '88 have, you know, any awareness of the spectrum, right? Like that's a very, you know, it's a pretty new concept.
Mm.
They, you know, in when we were working on the film in creation of it, they referenced Tommy a lot. So that's, you know, there were these kind of similar characters, but yeah, the way it was handled, you know, the way that those people lived in the world and the way that they were treated, it was just so different at that time. You know, the understanding of it was, you know, minimal, you know. At best, you know.
And I still feel like for a movie that's so definitely pinned to a specific time, like, hey, this is right before Super Mario Bros. 3 comes out, the storytelling and the acting, like, all hold up really well. Like, it was, no offense, it was very surprising to me to watch it just a couple of days ago and be like, oh, okay, like, yeah, this all holds up, even in the context of, hey, the Power Glove is out now. If you want to go by that.
Right. And you get that soundtrack, which is very much like, you know, Drum Machine's 1988.
Very much.
Oh, man. I love it, personally.
Oh, I love 80s synth music, but it definitely says this is from that period.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so specific. There's New Kids. There's two New Kids on the platform. It's so awesome. Send Me an Angel, which is such a great, rad, the best song. I love the music. That's definitely part of why I get sucked into the movie.
Wasn't Send Me an Angel also in the movie Rad, the BMX movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. Because I was like, I remember this being in a different 80s movie about a very popular thing.
But was it a montage? That's what I want to know. Was it also a montage song?
Well, it's in the dance number where they're dancing on BMX bikes, which I think is not a montage, but it is close enough, I think.
I love that this movie has a montage. It has a training montage with Nintendo games. That never struck me until yesterday as I was preparing for this, and I was like, I can't believe they're doing the montage scene and they're playing like Double Dragon.
And the game counselor who shows up.
That poor guy with his binders, he's buried.
That, you know, that's so awesome that that was a profession in '88.
I think there were, you know, a million kids who played video games, and their parents were like, I see this here in your Nintendo Power. You can call these guys, that's going to be you someday.
And then the internet came along, and once again, the internet has ruined us all.
I mean, those games were so hard. I don't know if I can't remember specifically, but I think that I called it at a certain point, because I was like, I'm stuck. I can't, you know, what do I do? And there was no internet. There's no, you know, if your friends haven't played the game, what do you do? Call them. And goddamn, it was expensive.
Yeah, it was like 75 cents a minute. Or yeah, $1.95.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So the most important question I think, you know, we have to ask you is, looking back at The Wizard, of all the games in there, which one's your favorite?
Man, Contra. I was always so partial to Contra. I destroyed that game.
That's great. I think most people would expect Ghost from Mario Brothers 3 because that was kind of the big game. But yeah, Contra. The NES version of that game is better than the arcade version. It's one of those rare experiences where, you know, owning it at home was better than playing it in the arcade.
Oh, totally. Well, it was a, you know, it was a hard game, and it was pretty important to have your secret thing in 30 lives in order to get to the end. And man, if you could figure that out, if you were in on that secret, poorly kept secret, the game was so fun. Oh my god! I mean, you know, I'm gonna go home and play it. I love that game so much. Love it.
Do you have any other like favorite anecdotes or experiences from working on The Wizard? I mean, you've kind of touched on things and you said, you know, most of your memories are homework, but I feel like, you know, surely there must have been, you said you went to a lot of different places in Nevada, North California, just like, I don't know, like, in all of that time you spent filming, like, what really stands out to you is, like, I love this moment, I love doing this.
You know, being on the back lot at Universal was really fun. I had taken the tour, I had ridden the King Kong ride, which is so, so awesome. It's gone now, but it was really great. I mean, you know, that's definitely one of the coolest things about working on a, you know, big studio film is, you know, you get to kind of be around all the stuff that's happening. So backlot at Universal was great, and you know, getting to go down into the ride and you know, all the weird little stuff they do, they, you know, have colored lights and flames and all this stuff, and to get to go down into it and actually see it was really awesome. You know, that and being in arcades and you know, the times when they would actually let me play video games, it was the best. I don't know. There's so much stuff that comes up for me when I watch the movie. You know, I mean, every frame almost that, you know, is a memory. It triggers, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, all the people that were around. And, I don't know. I mean, I should probably watch the movie and at some point and just take notes. You know, of all the
annotated wizard,
right? Of all the, you know, of all the weird experiences and trippy people, and God, I mean, you know, just so much fun stuff. The guys, you know, the guys who track us down and beat up Fred, they were sort of supposed to be, you know, punks. Those guys were so nice. They were just like the nicest guys in the world. You know, I remember one of them was like a gymnast kind of thing, and he could just do a standing backflip. I was like, wow, that's the coolest thing ever. This guy, you know, this guy's amazing. And then, you know, roll the take and we're like enemies. That thing is weird.
So how much of the movie was filmed on location, like around California, and how much was filmed actually at Universal?
All of it is basically on location, in the sense that when we're on the backlot at Universal, we're supposed to be on the backlot at Universal.
Right. So for like the video Armageddon or whatever at the end?
Which was on the back, you know, was on a stage. They, you know, they built
out. You've got like Wolfman out there. It's one of the, you know, the Universal monsters.
Yeah, right. You know, they did fudge a little bit. The tour definitely doesn't go by that at that time. You know, everything's changed, but at that time the tour never went by there. And you know, this was like a, you know, back corner of the lot where nobody goes. But they, you know, they built out that whole thing, and it was, you know, I mean, it was super cool. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was neat. It was neat to be on the back line at that time. That part, you know, King Kong ride burned down. It's really sad. Come on. Also, the earthquake ride. I remember the earthquake ride on that tour. So cool. You're in like a train station, and you know, earthquake happens. It all starts like falling apart. It's very cool. It's all gone now.
All right, that seems like a great place to end. So, thank you everyone for coming to the panel. Thank you, Luke, for taking the time coming all the way here from LA.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a trip.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could pick your brain a little bit about this movie. So just to kind of wrap up, you know, Retronauts podcast, you can listen to us weekly, actually more than weekly. Download us on iTunes or at retronauts.com. We'd love to have you listen to us. It'd be awesome. Follow us on Twitter, do all that stuff, yada yada yada. Luke, what kind of projects are you working on now? Is there anything you can talk about, or is everything like in development and secret still?
There are a couple things. There's a couple small roles that I did as an actor for films that are coming out soon. One of them is called The Super, with Val Kilmer, actually. Yeah, it's kind of a... I have a small role, but it's eventful. Anyway, that's coming out soon. What else? I just... a couple of the films that I have produced have come out recently. One of them is called Big Bear. Really fun comedy. You know, bunch of my friends, really cool guys, who wrote it and made it, and it's a fun movie. It'll be on Netflix eventually. It's kind of doing its you know, thing right now. What else? I don't know. Maybe that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, everyone should watch for those. And Chris, of course, thank you for coming and livening up the conversation.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks again, everyone. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Domino's week-long carry-out deal, you can carry out large three-topping pizzas and now medium three-topping handmade pan pizzas for $7.99 each. It's pantastic news.
Cut. Puns?
You mean pans? Calling all pan addicts for two layers of cheese on crispy golden crust. So grab your panty packs, because Domino's large three-topping pizzas and medium three-topping handmade pan pizzas are $7.99 each. It's pandemonium. Pantastico. Carry-out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.